It's done.
Connor McDavid! It's not real!
The goal of the year?
Panarin!
Part of the past. The celebrations? Forgotten. The history?
Vegas Golden Knights!
History. We're back to a blank slate. Clean ice. All that matters now is what happens next. The Stanley Cup Playoffs.
Eastern Conference Final begins Wednesday.
Think you know the Brooks Ghost? Think again. Introducing the all-new, better-than-ever Ghost 16. Now with nitrogen-infused cushioning for lightweight, supreme softness that feels good every step, every street, every single day. So go ahead, take your daily joyride in the all-new nitrogen-infused Ghost 16. It'll turn your everyday miles into everyday endorphins. Let's run there. Head to brooksrunning.com to learn more.
Now, you're listening to the Red Seat Podcast.
Red Sox fans have longed to hear it. The Boston Red Sox are world champions.
Hosted by Jake Devereaux.
It's gone!
Keaton DeRocher and Bob Osgood.
Sale winds, he fires.
Swing and a miss, strike play, it's over. The Red Sox have won the World Championship.
Welcome back to the Red Seat Podcast. This is your host, Jake Devereaux, and today I am joined by Keaton DeRocher and Bob Osgood of Over the Monster for episode 301 of the show. Gentlemen, welcome back to another episode. How are you guys doing tonight?
Doing great, Jake.
How you doing?
Doing great, Jake.
Yeah, both great.
Ready to talk about Richard Fitz for an hour and a half.
Yes, Richard Fitz. That's definitely his name. So that's the name right. We'll use on this podcast going forward. If you want to contact this podcast via email, you can do so at redseatpodcast@gmail.com. We did get a few of your messages today, so we're going to go ahead and get to those as well. But we have a full show lined up for you, and we're going to get right into it because we have a lot to talk about. Since the last time we podcasted, the Red Sox have made two trades. The first one we're going to talk about is the Alex Verdugo trade. So they traded away right fielder Alex Verdugo, who is a lefty in his last year of control, to the New York Yankees. In return, they received Richard Fitz, Greg Weissert, and Nicholas Judas. So let's start with you, Bob. What are your thoughts on moving Verdugo? It seems like we kind of all saw this coming, but maybe a little bit surprised about the fact that he ended up going to New York.
Yeah, I mean, that New York part, I have that visual of him in the outfield getting into it with the fans and people throwing beers and him having to be restrained. So hopefully they can repair that relationship early on over the next year. But yeah, I mean, we talked about it at the deadline. And we talked about it as almost a likelihood in the previous podcast in the offseason, so I wouldn't say that I'm surprised. I was a little surprised at first that it wasn't in return for a different need with the major league club. But I think, and you know, there's a long way to go in the offseason. I think as long as they use that money and turn around and make the signings that we are hoping that they do, that it's fine that they got, you know, some pitching depth, which seems to be a focus in multiple ways that we're going to talk about. You know, they're going to bring in another player here in the outfield that makes them kind of evening out the handedness, the left and right handedness of things, which I don't think was a surprise either. I think that's what we talked about all along, that there was a lot of left-handed hitting outfielders, and the other ones have more control than Verdugo does, and also, you know, a little less that's gone on in the clubhouse. I know we'll talk about that a little bit next, but it just made sense for him to move on. There's a lot that's happened in the last couple of years. You might say that Cora was doing backflips, who really knows that he doesn't have to deal with the biannual benching and answer to the press about a lack of hustle or showing up late or anything like that. So, yeah, I wasn't surprised. I would say I was surprised by where he went, and, you know, a little less than I expected with the return, but not terrible.
Well, let's talk about that return here. So the focal point of the return was certainly Richard Fitz, the starting pitcher. You know, he was with the Yankees at AA last year, had a really successful season, threw 152 and two-thirds innings there, 27 starts, struck out, you know, more than a batter per inning, didn't walk anybody. You know, he was really good at 2.53 walks per nine, 3.48 ERA, struggled a little bit with homers, but overall, he was very good, one of the best pitchers in the Eastern League this year. You know, the Red Sox clearly think that he can be a starter moving forward. He's mostly a fastball slider guy right now, but, you know, if he can develop a third pitch, it seems like he could be a guy that could stick in that role, and obviously good command and a guy who's already in the upper minors. So, yeah, I like Fitz quite a bit. Keaton, the other two guys in the return were Greg Weissert and Judas. Judas hasn't really debuted yet, but he's got some size. Weissert's a guy who's sort of major league ready right now. What did you think of the return? What was your take on it?
Yeah, I really thought it made more sense to move him in something for a starter. So getting back kind of a hodgepodge of relievers was a bit surprising. I think Weissert is kind of interesting. We were kind of talking about this before we recorded too. He's had really good numbers in the minors. He's had two stints in the majors that didn't go very well. Though the last one was at least better than the first one. So you feel like there's something there to mold. And I feel like we're going to get more into this later. But it seems to at least be able to start picking up on some trends with Breslow. And particularly it appears, at least among the pitchers, that he likes targeting guys that are still developing. And he can kind of sink his teeth into, for, I guess, lack of a better word there. Fitz and Weissert, I think, are kind of interesting in that they could help the team pretty soon. Judas, as you mentioned, I think was just drafted. He was in college last year. So not a whole lot to go on there except college numbers. So I feel like they're all interesting, but it feels a little underwhelming for Verdugo, who still has, I mean, he didn't have a bad year last year. Still pretty solid on the average. Doesn't strike out a ton. Doesn't really produce as much as you would hope. I think every year we were kind of hoping for his breakout and maybe thought we were getting in a little bit in 2023, but still seemed like a player that had values, plays really good defense in the outfield too. So it's not just kind of a slapstick bat. So it feels weird to kind of get guys that feel more like lottery tickets than somebody who can help major league team in a return for Verdugo. Unless it is kind of, as Bob mentioned, a way to create more moves later in the offseason here, which hopefully happens sooner than later if that's the case.
Well, let's go to the reason why they might have done this and moved him for, you know, what you might consider a little bit of an underwhelming return here. Bob, you mentioned the importance of this trade from a clubhouse perspective. So can you talk about that a little bit more and why they might have been motivated to get this done heading into 2024, kind of no matter what?
Yeah, I think, you know, at the end of 2022, when you saw Cora's quotes, you know, when they asked him who needs to take a step forward or what do you want to see from any specific players, and he called out Verdugo going into the season in a similar way like he used to do with Erod. I feel like that was his kind of more recent Erod that he just felt needed to be pushed oftentimes, and that, you know, sometimes he did that with more public quotes, and then Verdugo in the offseason really kind of took that to heart and said, you know, that he had worked hard and, you know, wanted to prove everybody wrong, and then he came out of the gate early in the season and did that with like a huge April into May, and then it just kind of ended up, as Keaton said, the same season that he's had 4 years in a row. You've got the game that he showed up late, and then it's as mad as we've really ever seen Cora at a player internally after that game, that, like, you know, just the quotes of, we just can't have this happening here, calling it unacceptable, everything else. He was benched a different time for a lack of hustle, and it just felt to me that it had to be done one way or another. And I was, you know, other teams probably knew that too. At least they did at the trade deadline. At least in the offseason, there were more kind of trade partners that they could work with than at the deadline, when they might have been just like a select few. And also, I feel like Breslow was more inclined to move Verdugo because he didn't make the Mookie Betts trade. So what does he care about moving on from that, you know? Whereas that was like the official L if Bloom had traded him at the deadline.
So what do you guys think of that? And I'll go with you for this one, Keaton. Does this effectively close the book on the Mookie thing? And do you think that that was purposeful in this context of kind of turning the page, not only from a clubhouse perspective, but from like a, let's not think about what we traded Mookie for anymore perspective?
No, I don't. I mean, yes, in the sense that I think it closes the book on that. Obviously, when you cut ties with the main return in that deal, then it's kind of over at that point. But the timing, just from like a career standpoint for Verdugo, made sense. Like, I mean, this was really just, it was the end of the line with the Red Sox unless he was going to get an extension. And that didn't really make sense for the direction of the club. And he still had value. Is heading into his age 28 season, is still a really effective fielder, decent hitter. You don't see the, I guess, necessarily the home runs or the RBIs that you would hope out of him. But that was something that we were kind of hoping for every season and just never materialized. You kind of know who he is at this point. I don't think there's a whole lot of projection left. It's a serviceable major league player, but it didn't fit the direction of the club. So I think that made more sense to trade him. Like, I mean, we were talking about this for, I mean, since the trade deadline this year. Like, I mean, we talked about it heading into the year, but he started off hot, so you thought maybe he was going to earn it. But then once we got to the trade deadline, team's not going anywhere. There's no sense at all that the Red Sox are going to keep him on an extension. The only outcome was a trade at that point. So I don't think it was heavily motivated by Mookie Betts at all, in the sense that it just, now was the time to trade him.
Yeah, it actually felt refreshing that they actually did it, because, you know, you get the sense that, like, this is the type of thing that Bloom would have talked about and then just not done. So it's nice that they went through with it. Let's do a hypothetical here. We're all sitting around sharing a buffalo chicken calzone, drinking a couple beers 5 years from now. How are you going to remember Alex Verdugo? Let's go with you first, Bob.
You know, as a solid player who had his moments, and just, I mean, the first moment that sticks out for me, right? So that there are some positives. You know, he was a good table setter at times. He had some really clutch hits, especially early on this year. I mean, numerous walk-offs, and I think the highs were high. But I mean, I think of him getting caught stealing against Houston, you know, when he really didn't get a lead and gets thrown out, and that's kind of how the game ended, and the series ended for that matter. And just a certain amount of kind of just poor defensive plays, mental lapses, poor base running mistakes that he made that just never felt like he could put it all together, even though we seem to think just because of the way that those highs were, the way that he would get the clutch hit, you know, had numerous walk-offs, all of that, it seemed like he could put it all together and then really just never did. So, you know, I'll look back at him as a pretty good player that, you know, I never really felt totally attached to here. And I also think that we'll probably look back on the next year of him destroying us for like 12 games against the Yankees every time that we play him, because he's going to be extra motivated, and that's when Verdugo's dangerous.
How about you, Keaton? What are you going to remember about Verdugo?
It's kind of a mixed bag. I mean, I feel like I'm going to remember him as a guy that, like, should have reached more of his potential, but just didn't quite get there, but was still a really effective member of the team.
Yeah, I think that's...
Fiery personality. I like the vibe. I mean, it seemed like it kind of soured there at the end here this season, but, like, the attitude, I loved it.
Yeah, I really wanted to like him. Like, it was the same way for me. Like, he was always on the verge of becoming one of those guys that was perennially one of my favorite players on the team. And he would do that for a while. And I think, like, when I think of it, there's kind of a duality of personality that I remember. You know, if you look back to the start of 2023, he had all those really clutch performances, clutch throws, clutch hits, like... He was kind of taking over that leadership role and taking that first step. But then, you know, I always will remember him acting like a baby about not making the All-Star team, too. So it's like there was a couple ways that he showed himself, you know. So I agree that he's going to absolutely murder us with the Yankees next year. But ultimately, like... I'm not sure he ever takes that step forward because of the immaturity. All right. Yeah. So the second trade that the Red Sox made was acquiring outfielder Tyler O'Neill, who's a right-handed hitter and can play all three outfield positions. To get O'Neill, they sent Nick Robertson and Victor Santos to the Cardinals. So let's start with you, Bob. How does O'Neill fit in with the Red Sox, and do you like the move?
Yeah, I think it's hard not to like the move because of how little they gave up and the fact that he's a free agent a year from now and that his arbitration number shouldn't be too crazy. So, you know, I don't want to talk about this ownership saving money again unless they turn around and spend this money, but the fact that Verdugo is going to be closer to $9 million and O'Neill probably be closer to $5 million because of these couple of down years that he's had and that they really sent nothing out. I mean, you want to talk about a player with 1 year left who didn't really have the greatest past season in the clubhouse. We sent one out and got another one in return in Tyler O'Neill, and really he kind of was in the doghouse in St. Louis early in the season for, I don't really know why. I mean, there was what was a perceived lack of hustle, and the highlight made the rounds, and it looked like he just was kind of slow and not running. It didn't look like he let up or anything like that. That was supposedly the play that got him in the doghouse, and then he got into more of a platoon role, and then he missed half the season with an injury. So, I think with O'Neill, you're looking at huge upside, but as has been the case with what this team has done a lot in the last couple of years, has the floor of somebody that just isn't on the field. I think the best part of this deal for them is his versatility in the outfield, because he has two gold gloves, he can play center field, and unless, you know, now that they've brought this right-handed bat in, I don't know that they're going to do anything else at outfield and DH. You could move Yoshida to DH so that he's playing the field, you know, only at home or less than half the time, and it might fit in a little bit more, where on the road, you know, you play Duran in left and O'Neill in center, and you've got some sort of Rafaela Abreu combination. You have a little bit more versatility there with a player that has really good defense historically and can play center field, and I think that that is going to be helpful for them, in addition to the fact that when he's on, which he was in 2021, he's got 34 home run, 15 stolen base upside. So, you know, do I expect that? No, but it's somewhere in the range of outcomes.
So let's get to that immense upside. We were all texting each other together when this trade went through, and I was like trying to find something wrong with the deal because I'm just fatalistic about the Red Sox. And Keaton pointed out, like, hey, man, doesn't have to have a downside. So, Keaton, I was hoping that you could talk about both sort of the light return and kind of how big that upside with O'Neill really is.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Bob was getting right into it. Even with the down years that he's had a career 111 WRC plus, which is pretty solid compared to Verdugo's 105. It's a little elevated there. He only played half the games last year. So if you kind of extrapolate his numbers out there, that's 20 homers and 10 steals. That's really great. He's also had some really good trends. Last three seasons, his walk rate has increased every year and his strikeout rate has decreased every year. So there's a lot to like in this stat line. Just like looking at the stat line, I was like, wow, there really seems like there is some course correction here due, and I'm going to look for him to have a better season just based off of this. So I got curious and started diving deeper. Took a look at a good old Baseball Savant, digging into the real details of that line. And I found some really interesting things I don't really know what to make of. So last year, he had an absurd barrel rate, 12.3, which is crazy high. His hard hit rate, too, was 43.3%. Also, very high. Both of those are very, very much above league average. However, his sweet spot was only 29%, which is extremely low. As I don't really know what to make of that, because normally barreling would be good contact, and obviously hitting hard hit rate kind of feeds into that as well. But the fact that he can't hit the sweet spot while making just a ton of hard contact is puzzling. And I don't really know what to make of that.
You think it has anything to do with, like, how hard he swings and the fact that he looks like Popeye?
Well, I mean, we've had guys that look like Popeye before. How potentially, you know, if it's like the plane of, what is it, the shoulders and the head there, if that's not level through the swing, then, yeah, he's changing his elevation. He's not getting the bat where he wants it. I will say I have not dug into the actual mechanics of his motion yet, just numbers here, but there's too much like positive trends and like good things in his line for him. I mean, like Bob said, I don't think I'm going to like bank on a 34 homer, 15 plus steal season while he's hitting nearly 290. That would be incredible, but I feel like the last 2 years that he's had that were down, I feel like there's too much in the stat line to like, for that to just kind of be who he is at this point. I think he can be better than that.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, the fact that he is still very much in his prime, he's in a walk year, he's got a change of scenery, you know, playing for a new manager. He's got a lot to play for, and you know, we have seen the talent. I think he finished in the top 7 or top 8 in the MVP vote in 2021. And this is a little bit different than a lot of the outfielders that the Red Sox have taken a flyer on before. You know, he can really do it all. I think the defense thing is huge to go along with the power. I mean, we talked about Hunter Renfroe a little bit as a comparison, you know, when we were texting back and forth about this, but Hunter Renfroe didn't play nearly as good a defense as he did, wasn't quite as versatile. So you have a lot of power there. I think the one or the two really big knocks on O'Neill would be just durability. He hasn't done a good job of staying on the field, and his strikeout rate is still extremely high. So those are two things to look out for. But, you know, I think that maybe the hardest thing is going to be Cora having to manage both O'Neill and Jaren Duran just like flexing at each other all the time in the clubhouse. Can you just imagine, like, Cora walks into the clubhouse at like 1 o'clock for a 7 o'clock game, and those two are just oiled up facing each other, like flexing at each other.
Lifting, and he's got to get them screaming at each other the entire time.
Yeah, they just got to like get them to calm down so they can actually have energy to play that night's game. I could just picture those two getting a little carried away.
Yeah, and just to, and you know, I don't have anything to add to that. That's a perfect visual. So, but just to go off of the barrels that Keaton was talking about, that's been the case for 3 years, and I don't think that he had any luck in that 2021 season. I think he just stayed on the field. I mean, his hard hit rate was 52% that year. His exit velocity was 93.
Bonkers.
Like, all of his expected stats went along with what he did. And as you said, Jake, it's contract year, right? He's a free agent a year from now. He's improved the strikeout rate. He's improved the walk rate. It's all a matter of staying on the field, and he's got solid defense to fall back on as well. So, yeah, I'm having trouble finding a negative. The only thing I can really think of here is that you've got some kind of injury-prone outfielders between, you know, Duran not making it through the season last year, and just the way that he plays, just balls to the wall on both sides of the field. And then O'Neill having injury history. I mean, if you lose one of those guys, then you're kind of back to short a little bit in the outfield. But I just have a feeling that they're done at outfield and DH, and that they're going to focus on pitching and hopefully a second baseman.
Yeah, I mean, looking at the swap, too, O'Neill for Verdugo, I think O'Neill has a much higher ceiling, probably a lower floor because he doesn't stay on the field as much as Verdugo does. But,
right,
man, when you look at the returns for these two guys, the return that the Red Sox got for Verdugo from the Yankees is substantially better than what the Red Sox gave up for O'Neill. They only sent Nick Robertson, who's, you know, a fringy reliever, who came over in the Kike Hernandez trade from the Dodgers, and then Victor Santos, who was actually the player to be named later for CJ Chatham from the Phillies a couple of years ago. And Santos is like a Orgy depth arm at this point. So you can't beat the price. And to get a guy with that high of upside at that price, I think is just, it's a hell of a move.
Yeah, we're waiting for the big move, but I think the small moves that Breslow's made so far, I mean, there's value in all of it.
And to connect the dots here between those first two segments, you mentioned basically swapping out Verdugo for O'Neill and then shipping out Verdugo, kind of putting the bow on the Mookie thing. So just to wrap that all up, Alex Verdugo in his Red Sox career, four seasons with the Red Sox, amassed a WAR of 8.0 in those four seasons. And Mookie Betts last year, just last year alone, 8.3.
Hmm. All right. Well, thanks
for the reminder.
Yeah.
And now we don't have to talk about it ever again.
Excellent. That is a good thing. The Red Sox also made a move in the Rule 5 draft towards the tail end of the winter meetings. They traded Justin Ammons, who was a recent draft pick who actually never debuted for the team, to the Mets to acquire Justin Slayton, a right-handed pitcher from the Texas Rangers, in the Rule 5 draft. So the Mets took him, but he never played a game for the Mets. Red Sox thought he would be gone, so they moved up to take him. He needs to stick on the Red Sox 26-man roster all season long to stay with the team. So let's go with you first, Bob. What do you think about the fact that they moved up to get this guy, and how does he fit in with the current bullpen?
Yeah, so the way that the Rule 5 draft went, the Red Sox lost a couple of arms that you'll get into, and then with the 8th pick, the Mets took Slayton, and then the Red Sox passed at 12, and my guess is that they were hoping that Slayton would be available based on the fact that they then turned around and made a trade with the Mets for an arm. It must be that the Mets liked Ammons more and the Red Sox liked Slayton more, and that ended up working out. This is really interesting because not only has he kind of improved in the minor leagues over the last couple of years, but he went out to Arizona in the fall league and pitched great there. And some of the numbers that Baseball America has with just the chase rates and his stuff numbers, which we know is something that Breslow's really was known for with Chicago and is probably focusing on. It seems like, along with Weissert and another name that they've signed, they're trying to stack relievers here. And they lost Fernandez already in the Rule 5. So between the numbers that Slayton had in the Fall League, and then I also, in AAA, Eno Saris has a AAA model of stuff numbers. And Slayton's stuff plus number was 132.2 in AAA. Now that's just 5 appearances, but it's 130 pitches, so there's a decent sample size. And it's next to names like Mason Miller, who has a 131. Abner Uribe from Milwaukee is a 135. I mean, it's a top 10 in all of AAA that he had for stuff numbers around some really, higher prospect rankings that you'd see, like a Mason Miller, a name that you hear is a lot more mainstream. So I think it's really interesting. And also, if worse comes to worse and it doesn't work out, you just return the player to the team, and it's like $50,000 or something like that. I mean, it's not that big of a deal if you have to return the player, but if it works out, then you're going to want to have him up on the roster for the whole year, as long as you have other players that have options that you can shift in and out at AAA.
Yeah, and he took some massive steps forward too. I mean, in 2022, Slayton was almost a 20% walk guy at AA, which is just completely untenable. And then last year, he walked guys at a 7.9% rate while striking out batters at a 37.4% rate at AA, which is just bananas. So, I mean, obviously a guy who they think can stick in the bullpen all year, especially if those command gains stay for him. One of the things that I wanted to ask you about, Keaton, was the guys that the Red Sox lost in the draft, and specifically Shane Drohan, who they lost to the White Sox with the 4th overall selection. This was a guy who, when we talked about the upcoming Rule 5 draft and the fact that he wasn't protected, that you were like pretty certain that he was going to get taken. And I think we agreed with you as well. So, what are your thoughts on that? Was there some sort of malpractice here from the Red Sox in not protecting him or trading him to just lose him for essentially nothing to the White Sox with such a high overall selection?
I don't think so. So, I mean, overall, last year was kind of a down year. I thought that he would be protected just given the state of the org, his proximity, and the need of the team. But I suppose it's not malpractice that they didn't. Because, I mean, he did have a down year. But they, especially in recent years, the Red Sox have had their fair share of bullpen arms that have walk per nines over 6. But they have really nice strikeout rates, and so you just kind of dream on it. And they never work out. Not a single one of them works out. They never do. So I think he was a guy where I was like looking at the strikeouts and his stuff and was like, seems like there's something here. But of course, he tends to walk the shit out of people, and that doesn't really help. Took some strides forward there at the beginning of the year in AA before his promotion to AAA, but then kind of fell off again. That first half of the year was repeating a stint at AA from the end of 2022. So he had been at that level. Seems like he adjusted quite well. Moved up to AAA and then kind of reverted to some old habits. Didn't really figure it out. But I still thought there was use for him in a Red Sox bullpen that is extremely top-heavy and then a whole lot of nonsense. But Breslow's kind of gone out of his way to fill that gap. And his approach to the guys that he's going after here, this is what we were talking about specifically before when we recorded, was I think a main difference between Bloom and Breslow so far is Bloom, in his approach to filling out the bullpen, would go after guys that were kind of lotto tickets, but they all had to stay on the major league roster. There was nowhere for them to go. Breslow is going after guys who may be lotto tickets, but they still have some development left, and he sees something that he can shape within them to get something out of them. But they also have the flexibility with these guys all have options. You mentioned that they're probably all going to start at AAA, which makes sense. And then if any of them pan out at AAA, shift them all up and you can get something out of them from there. But it gives the roster flexibility and an out in case they don't work out. And with Bloom, the guys that he added, if they didn't work out, they were still there. They had to stay on the roster because there's nowhere else for them to go and nobody in the high minors to replace them. Really kind of like accept Drohan. Like, I think we expected Drohan to be in the majors at some point last year, and he just couldn't stop walking people and kind of get out of his own way.
It's great. It's 6.4 per nine, and then he was giving up 2 homers per nine. They couldn't bring him up in a game that mattered.
Right. But coming into the year, we were talking about him as a guy that might be able to bail out some of these terrible major leaguers, and he just never reached that potential. So
yeah, exactly.
I can understand why they didn't. I just, given the roster construction of the team at the time, I felt like he was probably someone that they were going to protect, but I can kind of understand why they didn't. And especially now with the moves that they've made, they've basically replaced his spot there in AAA with guys that I think are far more intriguing. So
the White Sox are going to be horrendous, right? So they
yes,
like the Red Sox wouldn't have claimed a guy like Drohan that they would have to keep on their roster all year with walk numbers like that. I mean, they can kind of hide him for a year, you know, have him throw as their, you know, mop up guy or fifth starter or something like that on a team that probably is going to win 60 to 70 games. Whereas I don't know that Boston would have made a move like this.
No. And about 2/3 of their bullpen was hurt last year. So they really just need bodies.
Sure.
So if you're going to take a stab on a guy, sure. He kind of fits that mold of a guy that you would take a stab on to fill out a roster spot. So maybe they can get something out of him. But I don't have terribly high hopes. But I also like the shape of the Red Sox bullpen, the direction that it is heading now. And obviously still moves to be done. But the start from Breslow, I think, is really interesting. And I kind of like it.
Yeah, the only thing is I can't help but think when you lose a guy that high in the draft like they did last year with Thad Ward, you know, being taken first overall, and then with Drohan 4th overall this year, you think, you know, they could have been able to get at least like a player to be named later from a team via a trade. But, you know, maybe they did their due diligence and they weren't able to do that. Ultimately, I don't think it's really going to matter all that much. The other guy who was lost was Ryan Fernandez, who was taken 6th overall by the St. Louis Cardinals. He projects as a pure right-handed reliever for them. He's got excellent stuff, one of the better relief prospects that the Red Sox had. Really nasty slider, pretty good fastball. You know, he's a guy who I think has a pretty good chance to stick in middle relief role. He does have a pretty extensive injury history with the club, so, you know, maybe that could be something that holds him back. But I think both of these guys are fairly likely to stick with these clubs. What do you guys think?
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with that. And I mean, it was too bad to see Fernandez go, as he seemed like someone that you could throw into the mix of a high upside arm. But again, you there's a lot of those power reliever pitchers that tend to go in these Rule 5 drafts, and you lost one and you gained a different one, and I think it, you know, a year from now, we probably won't be talking about Ryan Fernandez's loss as something that hurt too much.
I don't know. So I was thinking about this one more and more. And our background all came from doing dynasty work and digging into prospects. And we would always be a lot higher on guys when they landed with certain organizations. The Cardinals are kind of one of those organizations. They constantly are churning out randos that contribute at a high level of the major league. And generally, they're pretty good at spotting pitchers.
Like Kyle Fernandez Gibson, has the Lance stuff Lynn.
That, like, he could be that next Cardinals rando that, like, rips off 3 All-Star appearances.
That wouldn't shock me. He has the stuff to do it, yeah. too. So,
and yeah, they got Nick Robertson in the O'Neill deal, so.
Yeah. Well, yeah, Nick Robertson's stuff and Fernandez's stuff, probably not quite apples to apples there, but, you know, who knows. Minor league phase of the Rule 5 draft as well. Red Sox lost 7 players there, which is kind of a lot. The way that this works, just a quick overview. There is a AAA reserve list of, I believe, 38 players, and it's not a public list. So, you know, other teams know about it, but the public doesn't. And if these guys are not protected on that list, they can be taken in the Rule 5 minor league draft, and they're not at risk to be returned. So the teams that got them just have them. The players who were taken from the Red Sox system were right-handed pitchers Jose Ramirez. He went to Chicago. Gianfranco Salazar went to St. Louis. Outfielder Alexis Hernandez went to Toronto. Right-handed pitcher Raylan Perez went to Houston. Right-handed pitcher Ryan Miller went to the Angels. Infielder Ryan Fitzgerald went to KC, and right-handed pitcher Brock Bell went to Cincinnati. So, any thoughts on any of those guys? Anybody you're going to miss, or do we just pretty much not care?
I'm ready to move on.
Okay. All right.
I want to hear your thoughts on Cooper Criswell.
All right. You'll get my thoughts on Cooper Criswell right now. In addition, the Red Sox signed Cooper Criswell to a 1-year deal worth $1 million. He had a really bad season last year. I'll give you the stats here. They're ugly. 33 innings pitched, 7.36 walks, walks, Ks per nine, and a 5.73 ERA with a whopping 19.4% home run to fly ball rate. So he was getting smashed all over the field. But there was a tweet that I found from our good friend Ian Kundle that says Criswell was in the 90th percentile for extension in limited walks and hard contact last year. His 88-mile-per-hour sinker got hit hard, but his sweeper and cutter were effective. So going back to what you said, Keaton, about you know, our guy Breslow having a bit of a type, here goes the sweeper again. And another tall guy. This is, you know, he's 6'6". Judas is 6'8", another guy he acquired. So he likes guys with size. He likes guys with a really good sweeper. So apparently they see something here. I know, Bob, you were a little bit surprised that they guaranteed $1 million to him. And I think it's fair to say I was too. So yeah, any expectations for our pal Cooper?
No, I don't really get it, but it's $1 million. So, I don't think that this is going to ruin the season by any means or their long-term plans. It just they're stockpiling arms. All of those arms so far have been right-handers. And all the other ones have stuff. Criswell is more, his location numbers are better. I don't know. I mean, you said what, he throws 88. So I don't know. I don't totally get it, but I do see that he has an option left. And they guaranteed 1 year. So I don't think it's that big of a deal. I'm just struggling to find anything in the profile, in the minor league numbers, in the major league numbers that make me think he's going to blow anybody away. But
yeah, I would second that. Keaton, what are you going to do with all your Cooper Criswell dynasty shares now?
Yeah. Well, I feel like now is the right time to sell high. I don't, just like Bob, I don't really have any expectations, but I do. I just realized this as I was scanning back over our agenda. You did start at the top and announce that the Red Sox had made two trades, and then we proceeded to talk about three.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, two major league trades, I suppose.
Yeah.
What's wrong with you?
Yeah. You know, counting's never been my strong suit. All right, so the Red Sox reportedly met with Yamamoto today as we are recording this on... What is today? Wednesday the 12th?
No.
It's not the 12th. Is it the 13th?
Yeah.
13th. Wednesday the 13th. There you go. And I think it's fair to say that it's going to be an uphill battle to sign Yamamoto. Apparently, Ohtani was at the meeting with Yamamoto and the Dodgers. The Yankees are offering lots of money. I mean, all the good teams want him, and he's probably going to get around, you know, $300 million or something like that. So, Keaton, how are you feeling? I want to kind of just take your temperature on the Yamamoto thing. Are you feeling more or less optimistic about signing him than you were, say, I don't know, at the start of the offseason?
I didn't feel great at the start of the off season, but I really hate that this is happening. But just because they're rumored to be in it and they met with them, I'm like, whoa, ho, ho, here we go. And I hate myself for that. Because I'm just setting myself up for failure, just ready to be hurt again. But that's just how I feel. So yeah, I feel like honestly, thank God that Ohtani went to the Dodgers, because if the Yankees landed Soto and the Blue Jays landed Ohtani, I was going to absolutely lose my mind if the Red Sox didn't get Yamamoto. I still feel that way. But it's going to hurt slightly less with that outcome. But yeah, I feel kind of optimistic because they're, I mean, one of six finalists is still a lot of teams. That's still a huge chance that it's not going to happen. But just the fact that they're in it and like actually in it and not just like posturing like they kind of had with a bunch of top free agents the last few years, they are actually in it. Makes me really excited. And the fact that the Yankees landed Soto. The Red Sox need to do something big that's as big as landing Soto, which this is the only thing left. It was Ohtani or Yamamoto. Those are the only two things that are on that level. And so if they're serious about all this nonsense, they got to land him.
Yeah, I feel more pessimistic about their chances at this point, especially because, you know, the number not be, we were talking about number being around $200 million for this player at the beginning of the year, and that's closer to what a lot of the, you know, projections were for him. And now the idea that this is creeping up to the 300s, it's just hard to imagine that this ownership group being as conservative as they have been over the last, you know, call it 7-8 years, would stretch to do that deal. So, I mean, what are you thinking, Bob? How are you gauging this Yamamoto situation?
Yeah, I totally get the pessimism and where that's coming from because of the ownership more than anything. But, like, if you looked at this just objectively without the ownership, they have the money to do it. They got in the room. They got a meeting. He's 25 years old. They're going to have to do something that makes them a little bit uncomfortable at some point, and this seems like the move to make, because otherwise you're going to have desperation, and all these other dominoes are going to fall from there. I mean, it's going to be Blake Snell and Jordan Montgomery and, you know, Imanaga. And then after that, it's, okay, well, if you lose out on Yamamoto and then those as well, you're looking at a trade, you're looking at a Brandon Woodruff project over 2 or 3 years or something that is going to be kind of equally uncomfortable. So I don't know. I mean, this is a guy that is entering his prime. It might take 9 or 10 years. It might take $275 to $300 million, but I don't know. They have the money to do this and more. If they do this, they can still go out and sign someone else after that. And yeah, I mean, I didn't feel like they were the favorite or anything like that. So I don't think I'm any more or less confident than I was outside of the fact that, you know, this bullshit with Ohtani's deal and the Dodgers saying, all right, you know, we'll save whatever the present value is, 40, 50, 70 million. And then we can go and add other guys to go with that. And I'm sure that's part of what they're selling him on with Ohtani in the room.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And let's get to that. I mean, Ohtani signed $700 million. Erod signed. Those are the only two guys that have signed really since we did our big free agent and trade target preview a couple weeks ago. So, Bob, let's start with you. What did you make of the Ohtani deal? Ohtani choosing the Dodgers over Toronto. It seemed those were the final two. And I guess, what are your thoughts on the structure of the contract too? The fact that he's only going to get $2 million a year for, you know, the 10 years that he's going to be playing, and he's going to get $68 million per on his Bobby Bonilla day, you know, moving forward. It seems like some people are crying foul about the structure of the deal, and I don't totally disagree. It's pretty unusual.
Yeah, you got to hope that this isn't the first of many, right? Because they probably can't look at this until the next bargaining agreement that's 3 years away. And there seems to be this increasing trend of, like, it started with the Bogarts, and even before that, like, Harper type of deals that got to, like, 10, 11, 12 years. Say, well, you know, the back end of that deal, I'm not going to be the general manager, or maybe as the owner, I'm not even going to own this team. It'll be somebody else's problem. So that seems to be increasing, right? That this is going to be somebody else's problem that has to deal with 8 years from now or 10 years that, you know, you have to pay someone some obscene amount. So you just got to hope that there's not kind of that trend of just, all right, we'll push that down however many years away, because that'll cause more problems down the line. In terms of where he ended up, it was quite a ride for those 2 days. I mean, the reports that were based, I mean, MLB trade rumors put up, you know, that he is going to sign there based off of some of those reports that came out on Friday, and some of those people that were fed some bad information, or who knows whether it was done to get the Dodgers to add another $100 million, use as leverage. But geez, yeah, I was convinced that he was going to Toronto based on those reports. Seemed like a done deal on Friday. And as Keaton said, sure, Soto's just a year, but for this year, you know, it would have been, all right, you're adding Soto, you're adding Ohtani to the division, and, it'd be trouble. So I am glad he's in the NL West at least.
So yeah, I'm the opposite of you guys with that. I was kind of bummed out that he didn't end up in Toronto, because I just wanted to see more Ohtani, and it's harder to see him on the West Coast, and, you know, harder to see him at Fenway and all that stuff. I've actually managed to see Ohtani at Fenway twice, once as a hitter and once as a pitcher, but, you know, more Ohtani is better for me as a baseball fan, even though it would be worse for the Red Sox, obviously.
But it's true out here that, like, the Dodgers games start, like, they're always 10-10 starts. They always have, like, the latest start on the slate. So even if you have the MLB package, you've got Freeman and Betts and Ohtani and whoever the hell else they sign here. You know, a lot of guys that you're not seeing as much on the East Coast.
That's why Central Time is the best time.
It's fair.
Right in the happy medium. So let's get to a question here from August West, who theorizes, you know, the Red Sox missing out on Yamamoto. He says, what does quote-unquote full throttle mean they will need to do when they miss out on Yamamoto? So he's saying, you know, what do they do in that situation? Ownership has basically stated that they are full throttle this offseason. So, Keaton, what do they do in the event that they miss out on Yamamoto? He's psyched by the fact that Ohtani is over there and Mookie and all the other cool players in LA, and he signs there and makes a crazy super team. Where do the Red Sox turn?
Well, and this is kind of piggybacks a bit off of what Bob already laid out there. Like, you're going to have to do something that makes you feel uncomfortable. Yamamoto is the right thing, right person to get uncomfortable with. Because if you miss out on him, you're going to have to do something stupid. And it makes it harder and harder. The less involved in these top guys that you are, it's going to be harder and harder to do something. Because I think you're going to have to try and swing a trade for someone, because there's not a whole lot left to sign after that. I don't think Montgomery and Snell qualify. One of those plus a trade for an absolute ace. Corbin Burns' name's been thrown around a lot. It feels like it's signing one of Montgomery and Snell and trading for Corbin Burns, and then also probably adding another piece. That's kind of one of those mid-tier to give yourself some depth and some quality there. But it's significantly harder if you don't. And if all you have to do is give Yamamoto money and you spent the last 4 years putting yourself in a position to where you feel like, okay, now we can spend money. He's the person to do it on. There's not...
Bingo.
We're not going to see this again.
It's been years that it, you know, oh, it's going to be this offseason, it's going to be that offseason. Well, we're here now.
Yeah.
So
the only thing I can think of, though,
you got a meeting with the guy.
With the phrasing full throttle, like, isn't that one of those, like, off-brand energy drinks? So it feels like that's the version of full throttle they're going for. We're not getting a Monster or a Red Bull. We're getting a full throttle.
Well,
they painted themselves into a corner by saying that nonsense.
I do think you nailed it, though, Keaton. The only way that I feel good about the offseason with them missing out on Yamamoto is a Montgomery plus a Burns or a Dylan Cease in a trade. And like, you know, you guys were saying, I mean, one, you're only giving up money. The second one, you're giving up substantial prospects to get one of those players back. And, you know, with Burns, it's only for a year. For Cease, it's only 2 years. So I'd feel a lot better if they went out and got their righty and a lefty by signing Yamamoto in Imanaga for money rather than, you know, going the other way and sort of piecemealing it through trade. How do you feel about this, Bob?
Yeah, I would prefer that. I wonder if they're going to want to go and give Yamamoto 9 or 10 years and then someone else 6 years. But they did say that they want to have control, right? And that's what makes me think that they're not going to go after Burns. You know, there's rumors of some of the Seattle guys like a Logan Gilbert. I think that makes a lot of sense, but what are you going to have to give up with that?
Yeah, I saw George Kirby, too, today, as floated as a name. So, I mean,
that would... Get most anybody up for George Kirby.
What are the Mariners doing?
I don't know.
The thing that... I guess Blake Snell is interested in going to Seattle, right? So that's the only way that I can see that happening, is if he wants to stay on the West Coast, Seattle signs Snell and then sends out a pitcher knowing that they have, like, 5 other pitchers. I mean, even, like... Brian Wu, and just how many that they've developed over the last couple of years. That's the only way I can see that happening. Kirby would be craziness. We'd give most anybody for him, I would think.
It feels like if you're trying to win games, you might want to just hold on to all three of those guys.
Yeah.
I mean, I'll let Jerry DePoto do Jerry DePoto things. And
well, he wants to win 84 games every year, right?
Yeah. If he wants to do that, we'll happily take one of those two guys. That's for sure. Right. All right. Let's get to our next question here from Lamonts. And it says, how would you feel if Montgomery signed for 5 and 125 and gave us this kind of stretch? And he's showing us the baseball reference page for my boy, Rick Porcello. And he says, seems like similar pitchers slash contracts with inflation between what JM will get and what RP was extended at, Rick Porcello and Jordan Montgomery, that is. 789 innings over 4 years with the following stats. WAR first, and I'm not sure what this is all saying. First,
it's listing his WAR by year.
Oh, okay, gotcha, gotcha.
I was like, "There's no possible way he was first in WAR."
Yeah, no, I didn't.
Yeah,
yeah. So he's basically saying the years would be half a WAR the first year, 4.7 the second year, 0.4, and then 2.7. I would be. This is an unfair question to ask me, isn't it?
Yeah, you love both of these guys.
Yeah, I do. I do.
I think it's a fair comparison. Like, especially the strikeout rate, right? Like,
yeah.
Over the last few years, you got to bump everything up about 10% because that's where the game has gone with more Ks. And Porcello, in those years in Boston, was 7.6 to 8.9 range per nine. And, I mean, that's what Montgomery's been. He's 8.4 per nine in his career. Walks 2.5 compared to 2.1 for Porcello. Both good control, a lot of innings. I think it's a good comparison. I don't think they're getting him for 5 for 125, though.
I don't either. And I also think that, like, you, if that's what Montgomery gives you with this deal, you don't look back on that deal as like, oh, it didn't work out. I think you look back on it as, that was a pretty good deal.
Yeah. What, if you win the Cy Young?
That's what I was going to say. My takeaway here is Montgomery wins the Cy Young at the Red Sox.
Yeah.
I feel okay about that. This makes a whole lot of sense for you, Jake, and also for me. I did not like Rick Porcello, and I'm not super big in Montgomery either, although I think I like Montgomery a little bit better than Porcello.
I think Montgomery's average year is better than Porcello's average season.
Yes. See, my whole thing was everybody would keep, and I know this was a reason you loved him, but dude going out there and throwing 200 innings every year, I hated it. I hated it so much because it was 200 really shitty innings, and I just felt like I'd rather have 130 really good innings and patch the other 70 together than have Blake 200 Snell, really poopy innings.
Yeah, it does sound like you want Blake Snell.
Yes, that's exactly why I brought his name up as a trade target the past 2 years. It's exactly my style.
Yeah, yeah. The fifth and the sixth year, you know, if he gets 6 years, I don't know if Jordan Montgomery 5 years from now, because he's about to be 31.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I don't know. If they give him a little bit more over 5 years, it's tough to envision him getting 6 years and that working out for the duration of the contract, but most of these don't at the end.
But also, Porcello started throwing 200 innings a season at, like, 20 years old. So, by the time he got to his mid-30s,
he was retired.
An insane amount of innings on his arm. And yeah, he was just like, yeah, that's all I got, guys. Sorry. I'm out. But how, man.
Do you have in front of you? How old do you think he is now?
36.
He's 34.
No way.
That's insane. He's been out of the league for... The last time he pitched was 2020 for 59 innings.
Yeah, so that was his age 30 season?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, he turned 31 that year.
Oh, wow.
That's nuts.
All right. Well, Let's move on from Rick Porcello before I start waxing poetic about his sub 100 pitch, nine inning games, his Maddoxes that I've seen him throw. But yeah, let's move on to LJ's question. She says, "Who the hell is Cooper Criswell?" We already answered that one. He's essentially nobody. And what is your dream rotation of Sox legends to include in the meeting with Yamamoto? Okay, so I want to take this one first. I've been thinking about this one a lot. And my dream rotation of Sox legends for a meeting with Yamamoto would include Poppy, Pedro, and drum roll, Dennis Eckersley.
Good.
Okay.
I just love the idea of like Eck being in the room. Just come on, man. You know you want to do it.
You got some hair.
Yeah, right?
I'm not going to elaborate. I wrote down Koji Uehara and Jim Rice.
Okay.
So, good ones.
So young and old. I like it.
Yep.
What'd you go with, Keaton?
Yeah, I had Poppy and Pedro for sure. And then I was trying to think of kind of the way that you went on like a personality or like a really good third option there. And I feel like, I mean, I guess not necessarily personality. Koji Uehara would have been a good one. I didn't think of that, but I should have. I was thinking Daisuke.
That's a good one. Because
he's continued to be connected with the org and has always spoken highly of them and convinced other players to come sign with us. So I was like, it feels like he's got the sway.
Yeah, he's an absolute legend. Yeah, and he knows what it's like to win here in Boston too. So that's a good one. Really good one. And a good question. Thank you for that. Our next question comes from Patty O'D. He says, "Hi, all. Congrats on your 300th podcast. I started listening in 2020 and I really loved it, so thanks for all you do. You helped me get through the ups and downs of my post-Mookie Sox experience. I don't know when you'll pod again, so I'll try to do something not extremely timely. Devers' play at third base this year seemed fairly awful, as I think it was safe to say. He failed both the eye test and the stats test at -9 defensive runs saved. Do you think he has the ability to become an even slightly above third baseman, average third baseman, or will they have to move him? If they have to move him off third base and he goes to first base or DH, does this make his contract tougher to justify, or does his hitting alone make him worth it? Thanks and congrats on 300. Here's 300 more. Thanks, Patty O'D. Great question. Let's go to you for this one, Bob. What are your thoughts on his ability to become a above average or slightly above average third baseman?
I don't think that he will be slightly above average. I think that he can get back close to average and do that for 2 or 3 years and be a DH around 30 to 31, which will still be the majority of the contract. And I think that they will do everything they can to work with him at third base. 2 years ago, he was that player close to, you know, zero and not -9. Obviously, last year didn't go well. You know, I think we broke this down late in the season, kind of whether who we saw as the DH, Devers, Yoshida. I'm just starting to think with the way that the lineup is shaping up that Yoshida might be more likely to be a DH this year and that they'll keep Devers at third for as long as they can. Obviously, if this doesn't go well again, they'll have to go a different direction eventually, but the 10-year extension has not kicked in yet. That starts this year. You have to think that they were expecting him to be at that position for 3, hopefully 4 years before they have to move him to DH. And I mean, he might force the issue if it doesn't go well, but I think they'll do all they can to keep him there and work with him, especially, you know, 26, 27 years old. You got to hope that can work out for a little bit. Above average, no.
Yeah, I got a hot take on this. I kind of think that after this year, we're going to be complaining about that contract not being so great, because I don't think he can get back to average at third base. What are your thoughts, Keaton? I hope you're not as pessimistic as I am.
I'm not at all. I even if he's at DH or first base, the contract is perfectly viable because you're paying him for his hitting. That is what all of that money is for. The defense does not matter. There's a whole bunch of other contracts, guys that are highly paid, where they're not contributing significantly defensively. It's all about scoring runs. And that's why you should be the DH next year, in my eyes. We're done. I'm done with him at third. You just can't do it. And I'm not going to try and stick it out for another 4 years until he gets to 30 years old and then move him to DH. Just do it now and get someone who can field the position. That's much more beneficial to the team and helping them win games.
If he sucks for 4 years over there, I'm not saying, you know, just keep writing him over at third. He throws everything into the stands.
Yeah, I'm on the same page with you there, Keaton. I'm on team Matt Chapman, come on down here. But, you know... That's just me. Let's end on a positive note here, though. Polly in Buffalo has a question-ish. It's not really a question.
He's got a great statement for us.
He does have a great statement for us, and he's connecting some dots. He's doing a little detective work here. So he says, Sox need to sign Montgomery and trade for Burns. From The Simpsons, Monty Burns, actually Charles Montgomery Burns, and the Charles River is right there, too. Just saying, that would be pretty cool. I like the detective work here. I think he's on to something. If we end up with a rotation that has Charles Montgomery Burns in it, I'm going to be pretty happy.
I love this, because this really kept me on my toes the entire time. What a twist. I did not see that's where that was going.
Agreed. Very good email from Polly, who has had a lot of nice things to say about the show. So we appreciate you listening, Polly. Great email.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for listening, Polly. Thanks for listening, Patio D. Everybody else here who's a regular listener for us, and if it's your first time joining us on the show, we hope you will join us again. You can follow us on Twitter. You can follow Keaton at The Spoken Keats. You can follow Bob at BobOsgood15. You can follow me at DevJake. And subscribe to the show, rate and review us. We are on the Monsters of Sox feed, along with Monsters of Sox and Pod on Lansdowne. And you can find all of our writings at Over the Monster. I just wrote about Yoshida today. Any of you guys got anything coming up you want to plug before we get on out of here?
Your face.
Ooh. I'm going to be writing about Garrett Whitlock, believe it or not.
All right. That's your guy. That's your guy, Garrett Whitlock.
See if I'm still on board.
Perfect. All right. Well, gentlemen, thank you for joining me today. Thank you guys for listening, and we'll be with you again in a week or two.